look at unconscious biases, kind of a common buzzword increasingly heard these days, and just a little bit of background on that will help inform our discussion about the 10 actionable steps. And the last thing I should say is because I'm from the National Center for Women in IT, a lot of my examples today, because we have a limited amount of time, will focus primarily on women, but it's important to point out that not all women are the same, right? They vary in terms of race, class, ability, religion, all kinds of other identities, and all people experience a range of these kinds of biases and issues that we'll be talking about. And the good news is that a lot of the actionable steps that we'll talk about are help make the environment inclusive for all people, not just specific to women. So, with that in mind, let's dive into the first topic of why diversity matters. So here you see a summary of some of the latest research in this space, and in the last 10 years, we've been able to document the benefits of diversity in much greater detail than before. And I'm not going to speak specifically about the benefits that you see here, but you can see the summary, in particular, better innovation and diverse teams being often better at problem solving and team productivity. And you can find out more about these exact studies at the link that you see there at the bottom. It's a research summary of all of these studies. But I just wanted to highlight a couple that are particularly relevant for today. And so the first of these is a large-scale study of more than 20,000 venture-backed companies. And they found that these companies that turned out to be successful startups had twice as many women in senior leadership positions as unsuccessful companies did. And, of course, the number was still quite low. The number in successful startups was about 7%. And only about 3.5% in the unsuccessful companies. And, of course, this is correlation. It's very difficult to prove causation in this kind of research. But it's still important, relevant information to have. And the second study I wanted to highlight was a study done by the Kauffman Foundation, and it found that women-led high-tech companies tended to launch with about 30 to 50% less capital than men, companies led by men, but were more likely to survive the transition from startup to established company. And they also found that venture-backed companies run by women had annual revenues on average that were 12% higher than companies run by men. And we don't know all the reasons for that, but we do have some ideas, and we can talk more about that if we have time in the question or answer. And also you can find, again, more information at that link. But just wanted to give you a few stats there, findings to weigh your appetite. And then, though we often talk about the business case when it comes to why companies should get involved in these matters, I did want to mention the moral case because this has been proving increasingly important, somewhat sometimes to maybe some people's surprise. But in particular, in our study of male allies at NCLIT, we studied men who were working in technology companies on gender and other kinds of diversity efforts. And they found increasingly that they used both the business case and the moral case to convince others to join, or that they were convinced by both of these cases. And often they said that the business case is what got them on board, right, and made them think that this was important, but because of the pressures of everyday life and work, it falls to the bottom of the pile, right? You just didn't have time to really focus on it. But once they heard by the moral case, I mean, hearing, the stories of how female colleagues had been treated in certain cases or experienced certain kinds of biases, or how their wives had, or other female folks that they knew, that this is what really motivated them to action. And so it took the business case to convince, but the moral case to actually move to action. So just to keep that in mind as we talk about some of these issues. So this spells a bit of trouble for the tech industry, this research that shows the benefits diversity brings. And as you can see here, I know people probably are aware of the fact that women's participation is low, but just want to give some actual stats in that regard. So you can see here that women comprise about 57% or more than half of U.S. professional occupations, and those are the occupations that typically require at least a four-year degree. But they hold only 25% of that the number declines depending on the kind of position and when you look at leadership. And this is also true of when it comes to race and ethnicity. For example, you see here that Black and Hispanic men hold only 9% of U.S. computing jobs, and the number is even lower for Black and Hispanic women at 4% of U.S. computing jobs. And it's also important to know that it's not just that people aren't entering these fields, we're also losing some of the diversity that is already there. In this, one of the largest studies on this topic, 74% of technical women surveyed reported that they loved their work, yet 56%, or more than half, had left by mid-career, which is usually defined as like 10 to 20 years into somebody's career, which is a costly time to lose somebody. And oftentimes people think, well, that's about the time people have, women are having children, and that's why they're leaving the career. But it turns out that 80% of those who had left actually stayed in the workforce, so only 20% took time out. And the 80% who stayed either stayed in technical positions but left the private sector study, and went to government or nonprofit, or in some cases startup companies. So that can actually be some good news for startup companies, and we can talk more about why that might be too if we have time in the questions. But and then the other half went to non-technical companies and non-technical positions. In other country companies or other arenas. So, what can we do about all of this, or why is this such a persistent problem? And that's really where the focus on unconscious bias comes in, because we know that these days it's not so much about overt discrimination, though that can still happen, but it really more is about these subtle implicit biases that no one intends, but they get encoded into kind of everyday interactions and business processes. But before I talk more about that, I wanted to check in here with this, our first poll. So if you could just choose all that apply here in terms of what you've heard or know about unconscious bias, you could go ahead and select as many as you as apply. Give a minute or so to do this, a few seconds. Do we know how many are on the call at this point? So I can know kind of what the response.
It looks like we have about 30 on.
Okay. A few more responses coming in. So it looks like most people have at least heard of it, quite a bit, know some about it. Many have experienced it, witnessed others experience it, and some have even intervened. Great. Okay, I'm going to go ahead and close the poll. Last second to weigh in. And so there you can see the results. So nearly half have intervened when seeing it happen. That's great. All right, good. So just to, I'm not going to say a lot about this. Like I said, it's going to be very brief, unconscious bias in like 3 minutes. But I will point you to where you can find out more information. But basically, this is a kind of a diagram we use to show how this phenomenon works, and that we're all growing up in society before we enter the workplace, and we are acquiring these schemas that have associated biases with them. And then we enter organizations, and the biases tend to play out in two different ways, either in these subtle dynamics, which are like everyday instances that may not seem like a big deal one off or one at a time, but really add up over time. And, oh, so I'm saying that you couldn't see the results, so I don't think I can go back now, but I guess I will read all of the results next time, sorry, about the poll. But to continue with the subtle dynamics. And then the other way these show up are institutional barriers, which are when these biases get encoded in processes around recruitment or retention or advancement. And so like I said, in the poll, it looked like at least a third of people had heard and knew quite a bit about unconscious bias, about nearly, and that was kind of where the knowledge maybe stopped, and then at least half or more had experienced it, and some a little less than that had intervened. So that's my quick summary of, by memory of the poll results. So just a few quick examples on subtle dynamics. And just to highlight some of that are related to micro inequities and personality penalties. And the first two kind of relate more to micro inequities, which are small slights that indicate that maybe people don't pay attention to you as much, or that you're not as valued in the company. And often we've heard, you know, if you do things as subtle as looking at a watch, your watch while somebody's talking, and not making eye contact. Often we've heard some of the things that you see here. Women will talk about, you know, coming to a meeting and being told that they are from design, or asked if they're from design, or if they're from recruiting, when they're actually the engineering manager. And but again, this can seem like maybe not a big deal if it happens once, but over time, this really starts to chip away at your sense of belonging, kind of like the dripping faucet icon that you see there. It just over time erodes a sense of belonging and engagement. And then personality penalties are, lots of research shows that women more frequently get comments like you see in the bottom two bullets about, you know, that they're being maybe too aggressive, or they kind of need to tone it down a little bit or work on their presentation style. And this criticism comes much more frequently in both formal performance evaluations as well as kind of informal conversations. And this has been replicated in study after study that this is more frequent experienced by women. And also people of color also have similar kinds of personality penalties. A common one there is often be told that you need to be a little more professional as a kind of code word for toning it down or not appearing so angry. And I wanted to show this slide just briefly because it helps indicate that this doesn't just start in the workplace. And so this slide comes from our Aspirations community, which is a group of high school juniors and seniors, girls who have won an award for Aspirations in Computing, and they then go on to be part of the Facebook community through college. And so one day one of them posed this question about what are phrases you're kind of tired of hearing or that you would want to tell people to avoid when talking to a female technical audience. And within minutes, I mean, this is just a screenshot of the early replies, but within minutes, a whole bunch of comments came in, hundreds of comments over the course of a few hours, and comments they'd heard throughout high school and college. And some of these are obviously problematic, but some of them may not be obvious, like, are you here with your boyfriend? That may not sound like a big deal, but it was said in the context of attending a hackathon or a coding competition, and people assumed that she was not there as a participant, but that she was there with her boyfriend. And so these things start, you know, early, and they enter the workplace with this as a lot of the background context. So that's just a quick, really quick overview, but you can find more about all of these and other kinds of biases that you see listed here, both in subtle everyday actions and in institutional practices. This is our new report, Women in Tech Facts. It's actually just hot off the press in the last week or two. And so it goes into much more detail about all of these. But I want to now turn to what we can do about all of this and talk about these 10 actionable steps. And just so you know that these aren't like willy-nilly freewheeling ideas you've come up with, and that they are actually based in quite a bit of research, and they're informed by this systemic change model that we have developed at NCWIT. And in the center of the model, we have top leadership support and managerial relationships, because these two components are really central to change, successful change, or building a successful culture. Without them, all of the areas on the outer circle will not be as effective. So, but the areas on the outer part of the circle are areas that need to be addressed when it comes to making systemic, sustained change and building an inclusive culture from the ground up. So I just want to take a closer look. Oh, it doesn't have the model on there, but it does have some of the areas to choose from. So let me just go back to the model here. And in case you can't see, the areas are interrupting everyday biases, employee development, addressing biases and performance evaluation, support for competing responsibilities, which is similar to flexible work, and then, of course, recruitment and selection. So I, again, just wanted to check in that, see who, which of these areas, and you can choose two, you are most, sort of your initial reaction that you're most concerned about. Everyday biases, employee development, performance and promotion procedures, flexible work, recruitment selection, top leadership management. So far, we have everyday biases and recruitment selection competing for the top position, with closely followed by top leadership support and manager education. Sounds like I'm announcing a race. 20 people have responded. Take a couple more seconds. Okay, I'm going to go ahead and close the poll. And can you see the results now? Do you think people can see the results, KP?
Yes.
Okay. So we can see that everyday biases, recruitment selection, and manager education relationships are the top for this group. That's great. And those are all, yes, very central, I think. All right. So before I launch into the 10 actionable steps, I also wanted to mention and have you keep in mind that early on is a particularly important time to start. So that's exciting when you're founding or starting a company, that culture happens either by design or by default, and that early on you have a chance to build it from the ground up, so it's particularly important and a unique opportunity rather than larger companies that sometimes have to undo years of conditioning or culture building. So the first actionable step is that we will ensure top leadership support, and this may seem like a obvious point, but it's so often overlooked and so often not present. But it really comes down to treating increasing diversity like any other critical business issue, right? And oftentimes there may be lip service given, but it's not treated like a business issue. Goals aren't set, and or if they are set, they're not adequately resourced. And so it's important to get that top leadership buy-in and hold people accountable to meeting goals, but also make sure that you're providing them with adequate personnel and funding and time to meet those goals. And just one caveat about this, and that is to avoid setting unrealistic goals. So especially since the push for releasing data publicly, especially in Silicon Valley and other areas that have been told pushed to release their diversity data publicly, it often puts pressure on leaders to then say things like, we're going to increase our diversity hires, we're going to double them in like 2 months. And that actually is not a good approach, given that it's unrealistic and unattainable, and when it's not attained, it can actually set that back. People get discouraged and say, this doesn't work. And so it's really important that the goals are realistic and that you develop a strategic plan. And that's why we have the change model, actually. And I'll refer you to some resources here on developing a strategic plan around realistic goals. And then the other important thing about support is public making public statements and commitments, but this will top leaders do that and reinforce this as a company value, and also that they attend events or meetings and actually stay. It sends a big message when you just kind of announce the event and then run out of the room, right? So making sure that these public statements and commitments are visible and backed by action. The second actionable step is involving majority group or male allies in change efforts. And we have a whole report on this that we can refer you to in a second. But I wanted to just make the point that you don't want to depend on underrepresented employees to advance diversity goals. And again, this is so often overlooked, or so often they are expected to advance these goals. And it's not often, I think Patrick Stewart kind of makes the point humorously here, it's not often you can bring Patrick Stewart in to support a point you're making. But as one of my other colleagues says, that, you know, depending on underrepresented employees is kind of like asking hungry people to cure world hunger, right? And it's not a perfect analogy, but it's really important to have those in power and those who are sort of in the majority group, whether it's race, gender, or any other kind of dynamic like that, working on these issues. And, of course, as we said at the beginning, this is really a business issue and it's a human issue. So it isn't just a woman's issue or a person of color's issue. And so it's important to have everybody involved working together to address these kinds of biases, because we all share these biases and have all grown up kind of in the same social milieu where we encounter these biases. So you see there at the bottom of the slide a link where you can find a toolkit for male or majority group allies. And this is a toolkit that's designed to raise awareness about what majority group allies can do and how they can get involved. We also have a report, a research report on this issue that's on our site as well. And we're in the process of developing a second stage toolkit that's focused on more detailed action that male allies can take or majority group allies can take once they've made the first steps. So I do want to spend a little bit of time, and I'll talk a little bit more about this one, recruitment, examining job descriptions, recruitment strategies, and interview practices. And a lot of you were interested in this in the poll. So, and I know this is a particularly important area for startups, so I'm going to spend probably a little bit more time on this one than some of the others, because it's also rather involved. So you can kind of see here that there's three components: job ads, sourcing, or where you're recruiting from, and then the interviewing and selection process. And so the first thing companies can do is to examine your job ads for sort of subtle hidden biases. And if you want, if you're interested in the research on this, I can point you to that, but there is research that shows that sort of subtle coded words tend to turn people off, particularly in some cases women, but they can also turn off a lot of men. And this is particularly the case for startups sometimes that ask, that are fond of asking for like rock star or world-class coders. And this kind of language that just subtly indicates that maybe this is not an environment where I would fit in, or even if I do perceive myself that way, I'm not sure they perceive me that way. It's kind of a complex issue, but it can be addressed relatively easily, and you see at the bottom there a link to a job description toolkit. It's a checklist and tips for analyzing existing ads and writing more inclusive ads. And the second area is, of course, examining your sourcing or recruiting strategies. And here you see just a clip that's actually included in our Women in Tech the Facts report, but it's from Rick Plow, a partner at Google Ventures, who described this exercise, a personal exercise that he conducted about his address book, and he also did it on his Twitter account. And he found, you know, that 20% of his contacts were women, and realized, you know, that, of course, if I just rely on my personal contacts, I'm going to be perpetuating the status quo, not out of any ill intent, but it's just who I know. I need to make a more conscious effort to improve my own ratio. And so the importance of actually going beyond word of mouth, even at the very beginning stages, because it's certain to replicate the status quo, and going beyond your usual sources. And you see at the bottom of the screen there just a few links to alternative pathways, kinds of sources. The Aspirations program is the NCWIT program I mentioned earlier with high school and college age young women who are accomplished in computing, and they work as interns with many of our member companies, and it's a community of thousands of women at this point. And then the other two links there are alternative pathway programs for people returning to work after time off. And companies, especially startups, have actually found that these employees bring a wealth of life experience and just need a little bit of time to catch up to technology, changing technologies, but that they can actually be very effective hires. And these are programs for both women and men, but a large majority of them are women. So the third area for recruiting is examining interview practices. And this is really important in terms of subtle messages that you communicate when bringing somebody in for an interview. And there's lots of research that shows that physical environment can give subtle cues. This is, again, can be particularly important for startups. Often try to, you know, create a more informal environment, but sometimes it inadvertently may communicate a programmer kind of culture or other kinds of cultures that maybe indicate that only a certain kind of person really fits in here. And it's not that you have to abolish all of those components of the physical environment, but creating multiple representations of things that, you know, people here do or relate to. And then ensuring diverse composition on the interview team itself is key because, as I noted at the very beginning, that diverse teams produce better results. Generally speaking, this is also true of interview teams, not just work teams. And I could say a lot more about that, too, in the question answer if people are interested. But I also wanted to point out the importance of examining interview questions and selection criteria. And so you can see here some of these things to do around that, making sure that the questions you're asking really get at what's required. Also reconsidering if you use these sort of defend your code, whiteboarding kinds of interviews where people have to get up and defend code and what can sometimes be a little bit of a hostile environment. And I think this is really important because sometimes people say, well, you know, everybody needs to be able to do that. And so I think you need to think about whether or not that really is a requirement of the job. But you also need to think, like, about the different kinds of experiences a different candidate has coming into that kind of interview. So if you remember the slide that I showed with the aspirations comments about all the things, the comments they've heard high school and college before even coming to the workplace, right? This has been their experience. And then they come into an interview room that maybe is likely all men, and then are asked to do this sort of hostile defender code approach, that they're really taking that interview under very different conditions than someone who hasn't had that experience prior to coming to the workplace. And actually research shows this a phenomenon called stereotype threat can kick in there and actually lower performance even when you're highly, highly qualified. So it could actually be helping, causing you to miss out on highly qualified talent even when it's right in front of your eyes. And just some final thoughts here about other red flag comments to look for in the interview and selection process. These are common phrases. We probably all said them. We probably all heard them. And it's not that they aren't, that there isn't some truth to them. You, of course, want to hire people that are a good fit for your company, but that's such a vague term that it can often be sort of code for these implicit biases that we're not even aware of. So asking people just, you know, what do you mean by that? And articulating what is meant by that can lead to a really productive discussion about whether this is something that's rubbing us the wrong way just because we're not used to this kind of, you know, personality or person in this job, or if it's really a problem for the company. So just in summary for this recruitment section, wanted to leave you with this thought, that questioning criteria is not the same as lowering standards. And we hear often like concern that some of these practices may lead to the lowering of standards, and I just want to reiterate that don't lower standards. Nobody wants you to lower standards. Nobody's recommending that. But questioning criteria is not the same thing, and even changing criteria is not the same thing. You may question the criteria and find out that it's all good, or you may realize, hey, maybe a few of these aren't so relevant, and they're actually causing us to miss out on highly qualified talent. So, moving on, number four. This also a really important thing to keep in mind. And it's pretty straightforward, really. But it's just an idea that you need to be focusing also on your company culture, not just outreach efforts or increasing participation at K-12 or higher ed or recruiting even. Though recruiting obviously is important, but you'll have to be working simultaneously on your culture. And that it will be very frustrating, you know, if you were to be successful at recruiting people into the company, but then they leave because the culture is not suitable for them. And it's kind of this idea that you know, want to get your house in order before inviting people in. And so often companies forget to do that and focus solely on, well, we just need to get them in here first, right? And so that can be a big mistake. And so just having an awareness of that and the discussion around that can be important. And the last five of these strategies, I'll move through pretty quickly and point you to a lot of resources where you can learn more about these. But these are all focused more on changing or establishing from the beginning an inclusive culture. And so a lot of you had mentioned that you were very interested in manager relationships and manager education around these issues. And that is, as I said earlier, key. Because, of course, you can have all of these great policies in place, but if your individual manager doesn't let you access them or makes your daily life work not so pleasant, then you'll leave. And we know that typically people leave managers, not companies. So we have this series of manager toolkits. There's a five-part series, and it helps managers address all kinds of biases. If they have responsibilities for recruiting, there's a box on that. There's also a box on employee development, team management, performance evaluation, and then supervisors as change agents. So you can check those out for more information on how to do this. And number six, ensuring productive team meetings. This is another one that is, I would say, huge and not, it doesn't require a fancy program. It's not that difficult to implement, but it's so underestimated in the effect that this has. And so we know a lot of times, right, that underrepresented groups, or when you're a minority in a majority team discussion, you often tend to get interrupted more, have a hard time getting a word in edgewise, or don't get credit for your ideas. So helping managers, but also other individual contributors or other members of the team, actively solicit the opinions of quieter employees or intervene. And it can be even done diplomatically, right, intervening when someone's interrupted or not getting credit. So you can also, there's tips on that in the manager box as well, and especially in the team management manager box. I'm going to move quickly through some of these so we have time for a few questions as well. But number seven is encouraging and modeling work-life alternatives. And so a lot of companies establish policies early on or later around flexible work, but the real thing that we try to stress with companies here is that often it's informal stigma or informal kind of unwritten rules that don't allow people to access them or penalize them if they subtly penalize them if they do. And so it's also important to establish a culture around this being okay, modeling work-life alternatives, senior leaders doing that, and not framing it as a women's issue, making it okay for women and men to take time off. And number eight is consciously developing underrepresented talent. And the key word here really is consciously, because, again, it's similar to recruiting, where we need to question kind of our schemas about who makes a good leader, question the criteria for when we think, oh, so-and-so would be good at this job. It's just natural to think of somebody like you or somebody that you've seen do a good job of that before, but maybe there are other people who also can do a good job. And so we also know that there are some biases around that happen and who gets selected for leadership development or who gets assigned certain tasks. And so looking at that carefully. And also consciously thinking of, you know, not just maybe coming, thinking of the first people to come to mind to recommend the speakers, but thinking of who, you know, maybe hasn't had an opportunity but would be great at this opportunity and recommending them. And then I'll kind of close here with the last two, which are both about data. The importance of ensuring that you have an ongoing commitment to reporting and tracking how you're doing in all of these issues, what kinds of, you know, how many people how diverse is the candidate pool, how diverse is the pool that gets hired and promoted, tracking attrition rates, those kinds of things. But we also encourage people, as they get a handle on these issues, to also expand the kinds of data they collect. Right now, companies tend to be collecting a lot of data just on sort of technical roles versus non-technical roles, and sort of women and racial ethnic minorities' participation in those technical roles. But we increasingly encourage people to look at what kinds of technical roles people are in. So do women have equal access to creation roles? Some research suggests that they're often channeled into or take on more execution roles. And this can kind of limit their potential in terms of contributions they make to actual innovation. So you can read more about that in our data collection guide, which you see at the bottom there. And that guide also has tips on strategic planning about how to put all of these efforts into place and develop a strategic plan to kind of help you prioritize. So I want to just move before my final slide to another quick poll of having kind of heard a quick overview here of just which one or two actions do you think you might most be able to prioritize or commit to today as next steps. And there's some other in case you want to. I didn't include all the ones we talked about, but there's most of them on there. Split I'm seeing. Okay, I'm going to go ahead 5 seconds and then I'll close the poll. All right, there we go, and there you can see the results. Coke. somebody text me if you can't see the results, but that is actually a fairly even split. Very interesting. A lot on collect data and progress, raise awareness, good place to start, educating managers, productive team meetings, yes, those are all great places to start. I'm assuming people can see those since I haven't gotten any messages. People can't. Okay. So just in closing, just want to encourage people to not be overwhelmed by all this information and to work on two tracks at once, right? There's things you can do, start small, start now, but also develop kind of a strategic plan that coordinates all of these efforts into a long-term kind of plan of things you might do later but maybe aren't ready to take on today. And not to give up, because in tech we kind of want things to change fast or we're used to things changing fast, but sometimes this is a huge, like, social, cultural pattern. Those patterns don't change as quickly. And so it's important to not be discouraged or give up if you don't see immediate results. And again, just a reminder of our resources, some of the resources that we have for you here. And then just my last thought was just this to leave you with is I love this sign. It's a sign that our executive director actually saw while she was driving traffic. You maybe have seen it yourself. She's frustrated and seeing traffic, and she saw the sign, and she's like, interesting. But we were talking about thought that it really is a great metaphor for culture. It may not, that we're not stuck in culture. It may often feel like it. We may be frustrated. It may be difficult. But ultimately, you know, we made the culture or are making it. And therefore, we can unmake it, remake it, or make it better for everyone. And so with that, I'll leave you with those words and I think we have some time for questions.
Yeah, so let's take the next few minutes here to jump into questions. We have a couple already, but if you want to use the chat function there, you can ask your questions, and then I'll go ahead and moderate them. But just to kind of jump into the first ones, one of the things you mentioned, Catherine, was that male or majority group allies are important, but it can be a bit tricky, or men are sometimes unsure about how exactly to go about being involved in these types of programs or worried about, you know, if they're doing something right or wrong. Can you say more about how we can address those concerns and make them more comfortable or have a better understanding?
Sure, yeah, that's a great question. So, and I think that is such a common concern, and that's part of the reason I would encourage people to check out the Male Ally Toolkit, because it does have tips for things to say, not say, and how to frame this, and what exactly men or males or majority group advocates should be advocating for. And so one of the key things is to remember that I think often things backfire or go wrong if male allies or any majority group ally tries to step in, or and if it's framed as sort of like saving or, you know, rescuing or helping even women, and rather it's more about helping the environment, right? It's not about helping women so much as helping the environment be a place where everybody can thrive and then everybody can help themselves. And so that's kind of a key distinction there. And then also we have to make it okay to talk about these things and make it okay to make mistakes. Because people will make mistakes, and always assuming best intentions before, you know, rushing to judgment, and that opening the conversation and making it okay to say the wrong thing with the right heart can be an important start.
Yeah. Thanks. Another question in kind of a comment is that recruiting and HR teams at IT firms kind of get the burden of diversity and inclusion work. What's the best way to spread the load of new work caused by putting these programs in place and raising awareness and consciousness about diversity and inclusion?
So can you repeat the first part of that question? I didn't hear.
Yeah, that recruiting and HR teams at companies get the burden of diversity and inclusion. So what's the best way to spread the load beyond kind of HR and recruiting?
Yeah, that's a great question, too. So, again, this also goes back, I think, to the importance of top leadership support. And so the senior leaders in the company need to make sure that these efforts are adequately resourced and that there are enough people employed working on them and they have enough time to do that. But also involving not just leaving it to HR, but involving it technical managers in the process as well, and partnerships between those two. And that's part of the reason that we created the manager toolkit, was so that technical managers could educate themselves about some of these issues and work either, you know, with their own teams, but also they could partner with HR on some of these issues so that it isn't just left to them, because also that it builds more buy-in if it's working across sort of those business functions. And so I would also check out the manager toolkit because there are some suggestions for both HR and managers in there.
Another question. So one of the listeners actually created a new association that launched this week. That's going to be addressing gender issues, and in particular, they're creating a Women's Speaker Bureau. Are there resources available from NCWIT or that you know of that would be helpful for that group?
Yes. all kinds. There's a couple things. I might check out our top 10 tips for increasing visibility of technical women. And if people want to email me after, I can also send you specific links. I would also check out our critical listening guide. That's a very new resource that helps people talk about these kinds of issues in research-based ways and avoid some of the pitfalls of what we like to call fix the woman approaches versus fix the environment approaches. And if the Speaker Bureau is going to be addressing all the technical issues, we also have some members who have done some great work in this space that we could talk with you in more detail about what they've done in terms of prepping women to so that they had a ready list of women to speak at conferences and things like that to sort of address the problem of people not always being able to find, claiming that they aren't able to find female speakers. Oh, and look, Jill just put the critical listening guide link in there. Thanks, Jill.
Yeah, I'll send that out. And then one final question so we can kind of wrap up here is that companies sometimes don't have women in these roles already. So when you talk about the recommendation of make sure that interview teams are diverse, what advice do you have for companies who currently have so few or no women, and that's really difficult to pull off.
Yeah, so that's a great question. I think, so we do actually recommend, like, if you have no technical women yet in your company, but you do have them in other parts of the company, that it can be worthwhile to include them on, even, you know, on technical interviews, because they will have just, from both a gender perspective, but also just a different business perspective, they'll have a different opinion about, or they'll likely see different insights. And so that it's worthwhile to think about that. But the other concern here is that you can also end up, if you only have a few women or other diverse range of employees, that they can get overburdened being on all the interview committees too, right? So you do have to think about that a little bit. And I think my advice is to do the best that you can with and be creative, but also be attentive to how much burden you're placing on those employees. But if you can't always have diverse interview teams, that it's important. It's, then it's even more important to pay attention to those other aspects of the recruiting process to make people feel welcome.
Great. I think that that wraps up the presentation today. Let everyone get to sort of their next meetings. Catherine, thank you so much for your time today, and to everyone who attended, thank you for putting up with us at the beginning while we worked through those technical difficulties. I'm sure most of you have put on webinars, and it would not be a webinar if we didn't run into that every so often. So I appreciate that. We will be sending out the recording, as I mentioned, along with the deck, and as Catherine also said, you can email her with any questions, and you all have my email from the registration, so if anything does come up, please feel free to shoot me a note as well, and we will get that handled. So thank you again for attending, and we look forward to having you at one of our events again soon. Bye.